Welcome to the Sexual Mindfulness Project podcast, where we talk about creating an intentional relationship and how to find joy in slowing down, letting go of judgment, and connecting more deeply with your partner.
Well, I'm really delighted today to have Chelsea Johnson with us. I'm going to actually let Chelsea just give us a little background on her, where she comes from, her perspective.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Shalom. I really appreciate it. I am a associate marriage and family therapist working under the umbrella of Covenant Sex Therapy. I'm in Southern Utah. I graduated from North Central University, and I actually specialized in child and adolescent therapy because I had been doing preschool out of my home for 8 years and daycare before that. And I really love children. And I don't regret that. Although what I found as I started doing various types of therapy, and in particular couples therapy, I realized how important it was for couples to get the resources and the conversations they needed about sex specifically and that form of connection. And I became quite passionate about it. And so now that's what I devote most of my time to in terms of study as well as clinical work.
That's great. That's great. And I love that you started studying children or doing therapy for children. Truthfully, I think that if we don't have a pretty good understanding of human development, like just how our mind works when we're children, it's going to be tough for us to understand how our mind works now that we're adults.
Right. Well, and many couples fight quite hard about parenting issues. And so knowing a lot about children and their development, as you say, as well as strategies for how to facilitate the most healthy development possible, I think is really important to clinical work.
Okay. I love that. Tell us, what was your journey that brought you to be a sex therapist?
In truth, my marriage really suffered for a number of years in this respect. And so a handful of years ago, I finally listened a little more deeply to what my husband kept bringing to me, which was, you don't settle in any area of your life except this one. You are so attentive to every other domain of your life, and I feel like you ignore this one. And so for years, I had been very defensive about this, and had denied. And finally, I decided to take him up on self-confronting a little more about that and realized I had a considerable amount of work to do about that. And I was very quick to say that I wasn't the only one. I wasn't the only one who needed to grow in order to develop the sort of marriage and sex life in particular that we both wanted deeply. But that's kind of what started it, is that we went on a journey together that took several years and was extremely painful. There were very few indicators for either of us, I would say, to lead us to believe that we would be successful. And it was really kind of at that point where I realized this is a journey worth undertaking and pursuing to the end, whether our marriage survives or not, whether our sex life gets better or not. And it was kind of that shift that made all of the difference and is the one that I try to bring into clinical work now, because without a focus on virtue, on something beyond reducing our pain and our anxiety and discomfort, I don't think we develop the strength required for the sex we want.
Yeah, I love that. I love how you're talking about growth of the individual, whether or not there remains a connection in the relationship, because sometimes that is the case, right? We may be in a relationship where things have deteriorated to the point, or there's abuse or some other context that really probably just indicates that the relationship won't survive, but we ourselves can still develop. And particularly in relationships where the relationship can survive. Mm-hmm. And yet we have to confront ourselves. We can't always be saying, well, you know, buddy, you have problems too.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
We have to face ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And I actually ask clients to consider, even when they are convinced, when they begin treatment, that this relationship can't possibly survive, you know, is that, okay, how about you not give up that conclusion, but you still use your opportunities, your growth opportunities in your current relationship to build yourself, as you were saying, to do the individual work that I know I need to do regardless of the relationship that I'm in,
right.
And then find out, decide, reevaluate in 3 to 6 months, do I still believe that this relationship is unsalvageable, or did I simply need to grow up some, and my spouse too?
Yeah, which is likely the case, right? We know that most marriages, even that are troubled, it's a salvageable relationship. We just both have to do some pretty serious growing up. And truthfully, that's uncomfortable. And I don't think we've been well prepared for it in our families or our religious mm-hmm. communities or just our communities in a larger context. So that it's a little bit of a surprise to us. Mm-hmm. And I know that you use kind of a virtue-based therapy. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you would maybe share with us what that looks like, why you use that.
Sure. Yeah. So I really value a lot of the other models that I've learned about and that I use. So in particular, you know, attachment theory is really important, I believe, in understanding the need for connection. And I really appreciate the wisdom in differentiation theory that we've, you know, alluded to a few minutes ago. And so in my view, the way to utilize the best of both of those seemingly contentious models is to put them under the umbrella of virtue and to prioritize that first. So in my view, seeking and honoring virtue is the most effective and sustainable and noble way for us to promote personal and relational and even social flourishing. And so in my view, the primary virtue is love. And while it can't actually be divided or doesn't need to be, we can think of it at least as being divided into love of people and love of truth. So charity and integrity, I would say. And so the most fundamental commitments I think that we have to make at a minimum, if we want to be serious in this endeavor toward virtue, is to show up in meaningful ways and then also to tell the truth. And so to the degree that we do that, I think we make attachment in its best sense possible, as well as the differentiation that we all need.
And I think I know what you mean by showing up, right? We have to mm-hmm. first show up and tell the truth or be honest. But just for our listeners' sake, describe what you mean by showing up.
Sure. I think there are a number of ways to think about this. And the one that I prefer is one in focuses on how are we investing in ways that are actually trackable and measurable by the people that deserve our investment. So to be more clear, maybe, you know, if my husband doesn't know how to feel connected to me unless there's some degree of touch, sexual or otherwise, you know, and I want to show it through giving him gifts. So you could bring in love language theory here if you wanted to. But in other words, you know, am I actually investing in ways that my partner or this other loved person will feel from me? And am I willing for them to offer me feedback about how well they can feel my investment? That's what showing up does not mean showing up simply well-boundaried. So that's the other part. Having integrity is about being well-boundaried. And I would say socially, there's lots of support for this. And a lot of it is good. But boundaries aren't enough. Boundaries is where conversations about investment start.
I love that. And I love that you're not saying, okay, if I just spend an hour, let's say I even spend an hour a day with my spouse, just because I'm physically present doesn't necessarily mean I'm showing up, no. Right? I have to show up in this quality that you're talking about.
Right. And I don't mean to pick on women. I think there's growth opportunities on both sides, but I think we talk sometimes less about growth opportunities of women in marriage and the sexual domain in particular. And a lot of women are willing to show up really regularly, emotionally and verbally, and then wonder why their husband still can't feel them. And they get quite defensive about about the notion that they're not doing enough to show that. And so I have particular experiments that I recommend to couples to ensure that women do not perform or placate or anything contaminated, I would say, in their effort to show up in meaningful ways, but still gives them the space and the conversations and the facilitation that they both need to find out what is possible in terms of connecting physically and sexually right now that is in a way that is genuine.
I like that. So I think you're maybe emphasizing the other side just so that, you know, maybe women can hear where they can grow as well. And that is maybe a particular spouse is showing up emotionally, right? They're there to discuss the feelings and expectations. but they're not showing up physically, right? Right. Where they're not giving physical touch or allowing there to be opportunities where sexually you connect. And if that's your spouse's love language, that's important as well. So understanding how your spouse needs you to show up and then making an effort to show up in that way.
Precisely. And that's what I'll discuss with men. It's not always men, but often men are the higher desire partners. And what I will ask them to consider is, are you really prepared to show your wife that while, of course, you do want to have sex to connect with her in a uniquely wonderful way for you, do you want even more to know her and to find out if she doesn't want to have sex with you today, why? And yeah. Do you care?
Yeah.
Do you care about those reasons?
Yeah, those are the questions that scare us. And then we run in the other direction. It's like, yeah, I want to have sex, but she doesn't want to, and I don't want to know why. Because mm-hmm. that takes me into an area of our relationship that I'm really uncomfortable and mm-hmm. I'm going to avoid it at all costs, even if it means doing without what I need, which is that physical touch.
Exactly. Exactly. And so one of the classic first experiments I'll offer clients is something like, you know, several times a week to come together for a 60-minute bedroom date. I call it, I'm still working on what to call it exactly, but in which there is no distraction, there is no media, there is no other activity to do to distract you from the hard questions that you're talking about and that really honest communication. And so the goal is to not have sex. It's also not to avoid sex. Sex is always on the table, but what is driven by is 100% honest verbal communication and then getting as close physically and even intimately as the lower desire can do so genuinely.
I love that.
Right. So that's where you see the higher desire is able to see the lower desire's efforts in stretching themselves in all the ways that are good.
Mm-hmm.
And they can feel it. And then the lower desire feels that investment from the higher desire in that you're serious. Like you really want to know why I can't even fathom the thought of having intercourse with you tonight. You don't want me to just stoke your ego or make you feel good or reassure you that you're wanted.
Yeah,
right now,
everything's okay. Let's just put a Band-Aid on this and have sex. Instead, you're challenging them to take it as slowly as is necessary, but start investigating these other areas of your relationship, which may be emotional, but they may be physical. Mm-hmm. They may be, you know, a combination of I'm holding a hurt that hasn't been resolved, and that's why I don't have a desire to have sex. And so this beautiful opportunity to kind of explore that will mm-hmm. help you possibly identify it and begin to resolve it. Is that the goal?
Yeah. And those places where they're trying to get underneath the surface that these other models come in really brilliantly, I think like EFT, the emotion focused therapy of attachment, where you begin in your anger. I call them red emotions with clients because we can feel the heat in our body. We know when it's something, you know, in the neighborhood of anger. And then we know we have an opportunity then to also share the blue, let's say, emotion underneath the surface, under the water. I'll say that to children sometimes, what's under the water? And they say, so here are the things that I am afraid of or pained by that I feel like are obstacles between me and you in these ways, physically or emotionally or both. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the one other comment I want to make about that is that the only limitation I see in that, it's called the primary emotions focused, right? The deeper emotions of pain and fear is that in some ways, I think socially and therapeutically, even we don't give enough credit to what else might be lurking in a good way under the surface, that it's not just negative emotion that is at our core, that there are hopes and dreams and commitments that we have that are the reasons why we're in pain or we're afraid.
That's so beautiful. And I love kind of the visual of the color or the heat or the water. I think that that helps people really feel what it is that they need to do. Mm-hmm. That's great. Maybe you'll talk to us just a minute about how integrity, responsibility, and virtue play into a sexual relationship.
Mm-hmm. In order, in my view, to have sex that is worth having, you have to be there fully. And there is no way to do that unless you're willing to have integrity or more simply to be honest, to tell the truth. And so one thing I'll tell clients is when they describe the sort of patterns they've been in and how in some ways they want to minimize their pain and discomfort, I'll say, I'm happy to help you find a pathway to good sex, but I'm not interested in helping you continue to have bad sex. And if you want good sex, then we need to be able to develop your tolerance for being responsible for your own feelings and your own experience, and to be willing to articulate that to your spouse, regardless of their response, regardless of their reactions. And it requires a tremendous amount of personal strength and character to do this, which you're not going to develop overnight, and that's okay. But if your intent is there, you can slowly but surely develop the sort of stature that you need to play sexually. And at its best, I would think that that's what sex is. And I've heard that from many others, that sex for adults ought to be about honest, unabashed play. And if you are so raw and so unsure about your value and your accountability that you have to be protecting yourself at every turn. You know, when you watch children, you know the children that everyone wants to play with are the ones that know what they want to play, and they will negotiate the play. But if they sulk, and if they accuse, and if they withdraw, and if they do all these other things that adults do all the time in their sexual relationships, nobody wants to play with them, and they shouldn't. They shouldn't. I mean, but what's wonderful about being an adult is that we can go to our partner and say, I don't want to play with you when you get angry and resentful and sulky. You know, I don't want to have sex with you right now, but I do want to help you take on your responsibility to process your feelings. And I am here for you unconditionally in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's where the nurturing comes in. I think I just briefly want to touch back on attachment theory, that I think it's dangerous to focus too much to think of our spouses as our like secure attachment figures in a nurturing sense, because what I'll say sometimes to husbands in particular is, do you want a mother or a lover? You can't have both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
However, I will say again, I think we ought to show up unconditionally to help our spouses process all that they need to emotionally and spiritually to develop. But that's different than taking it on and not being honest about how it impacts us, the way a parent never goes to their child and expects something reciprocal. At any rate, I think we can nurture well at any time, but we should not mix that in with sex. Sex is not for nurturing. Sex is for playing.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think you're touching on the riskiness of the relationship, right? We are being vulnerable in a way that isn't just about nurturing or making a safe place for us. We're actually pushing each other into risky areas in, mm-hmm. You know, emotionally in particular, that we're trying things that we've never tried with another person, whether that's sexually or being vulnerable in these, in sharing things that we haven't shared, even with friends, maybe, and, mm-hmm. and because it wasn't appropriate. But here we are in this intimate relationship. We're allowing ourselves to be fully seen. And that's scary.
Oh, that
feels scary. Yeah, it's terrifying at times. So what if you've done that and you've been hurt, right? It hasn't been safe. You've been wounded through this relationship. And so, of course, your sexual desire will take a hit because of that. And you're wanting to be open, but you feel like your partner isn't creating that nurturing environment that's needed. You want to be honest about those feelings. How would you counsel a couple like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Safe is quite a tricky word right now, I think. And in some ways, I would prefer to distinguish separate safe from nurturing.
Okay.
Although I see how they're often related, or at a minimum, let's say if we keep them together, then at a minimum, I would say we need to help couples focus on the nurturing part that in outside of sexual interaction. So as often, let's say, if you're feeling hurt and wounded as a part sexual and, you know, a marital partner, then you pause the sexual activity to get into the nurturing zone. You do all the expressive stuff, you feel safe, you feel nurtured, you feel reassured of your value. If you need that, you try to assert that yourself as well as you can. And then you see if you're ready to play again. You don't attempt to play. Again, you don't try to get your partner to be your mother and lover at the same time, yeah, at the very least.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. That's a really nice model for us to look at, to consider when we're trying to work through issues in our own sexual relationships, within our own marriages. Let's shift gears a little bit. How do you think religion may be both a blessing and a curse to a marriage?
I would say that to the degree religion supports couples in pursuing virtue, it blesses the marriage sexually and otherwise. So if we use the way that I've defined that, I would say to the degree that religion supports couples in telling the truth about all things, telling the truth about at least how they see and experience things, as well as supporting them and showing up in their marriages, will be a real blessing to people. In my experience, personally and professionally, I would say that religion often does a really admirable job of the latter, does a really good job of reminding people that it's worth showing up no matter how hard it is. You know, like you can stick it out in most cases. You can figure this out. Let's do this. Let's do hard things, right? The other, I'm not fully persuaded, is sufficiently prioritized, the telling the truth about where you are, having integrity at any cost. I'm not sure how, with the way religions are typically structured, I don't know if it can be sufficiently prioritized.
What do you mean by that? That we kind of sulk and don't say what we really are feeling? We kind of tamp down some of those feelings that we feel won't be acceptable in the relationship? Is that one way that we aren't honest?
I would say it's even deeper than that, that in the relationships that we are afraid that it's actually immoral, that we actually should feel guilt about being straightforward about things that we know may be painful for others. And that I believe that we are socialized to some degree, including or specifically in religious institutions, to believe that there are certain things I should tell the truth about and other things that I should obscure because it would not be reinforcing the truth claims on the table. And that if I disrupt that, then I'm not good anymore.
Could you give me an example?
Sure. So if I've been really fascinated watching, you know, because I grew up and continue to participate in certain ways within the LDS church. And my husband is fully practicing and my children as well. And so I've had a lot of discussions and experiences with this particular religion. And so going back to what I'm fascinated by, I've been watching in the last 5 to 10 years, the plethora of articles and discussions surrounding, you know, say the priesthood and presiding and the roles of men and women. And so what I've been noticing is that I kind of get this, the feeling, the messaging from those that there's nothing to be concerned about here. And yet we keep talking about it. I don't think there's sufficient clarity about what it means to have an equal marriage. And so when we talk about the word preside in particular, because it is so difficult, in my view, at that point, to talk about that, say, straightforwardly in a church meeting, in my view, is not going to be supported if it's not a positive reinforcement of the term preside, say, then there's nowhere that the conversation can go, from my experience.
So are you talking about in a larger context, like the church? Maybe it wouldn't be supported in a Sunday school class, but maybe within our own marriage, we have been able to kind of define and understand what preside means within our own relationship.
Certainly. I think that's exactly what every successful LDS couple has done. I would also say that I have never personally come up with a suitable definition for preside in the frame of an equal marriage, but other people seem to have landed on something. and that they're thriving.
Yeah. Okay. So being honest about things that we may just fundamentally disagree with each other. And so instead of continuing that conversation, having those hard conversations where we muddle through, right? We may not find perfect alignment with each other, but we muddle through the discussion. That's more an example of what you're suggesting is maintaining that honesty, right? We show up, we have integrity, mm-hmm. then we also have to have this second component, which is honesty. In other words, really talking about what I truly feel, hold dear, even if it's, you know, in opposition to what my spouse may think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And I love the quote, and I really wish I could remember his name right now. I apologize. But, you know, he says that even when a unity of belief is not possible, a unity of love always is. And I would say, you know, within that love, again, integrity is a part of that. And so what I have seen possible in my own marriage, as well as others, is that we can lovingly support and even encourage each other in the pursuit of integrity, even when that means that there are irreconcilable differences and disagreements about what that looks like. And so I would even use the term repentance in about this. I found I needed to repent in the way that I was approaching my marriage at a certain point of my own development with this, in which I wasn't loving and respectful of my husband's integrity and wanting to stay fully invested in the church, in religion. And I realized that I was not, you know, aligned with my own values in behaving that way. And so it hasn't been easy and it continues to be challenging. But that's what our, you know, in my marriage, that's what we're striving for, is being able to be uncensored in our discussion of what we agree and disagree about, and to continue forward under the umbrella of we're both committed to integrity and to love.
I love that. Yeah, I remember just recently listening to a podcast by Thomas McConkie, and he was talking about how sometimes we fragment little portions of who we are, and because we've been wounded, right? So we kind of cordon that off to protect it. But what ends up happening is that we can't really enjoy the fullness of who we are or who our partner is, if we're cordoning off little areas mm-hmm. of what we feel or think or believe or have experienced. So like you're saying, you know, really unabashedly sharing my essence, right? My soul, everything I believe and think and do, and being unembarrassed about that. But that takes an awful lot of strength for us to both bring that to the table and then sort through it. Mm-hmm. Those are some pretty deep conversations.
That's right. And I think we can ask ourselves some open-ended questions when we feel stumped or we feel tempted to resist going to all the corners of the soul of our spouses.
Yeah.
You know, we can ask things like, which part of me is underdeveloped in such a way that I fear I will not be able to stand in my own understanding of truth if they share theirs with me?
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe even what image have I created of my spouse that if they tell me something that is not aligned with that image, that scares me. You know, what does that say about what I've created and their willingness to be vulnerable and my willingness to be accepting of what I hear that, yeah, maybe they don't want to be the, it takes, you know, let's go back to sex for a minute. Maybe they don't feel that they are the ever ready sexual partner. Mm-hmm. And that's a role they've taken on because society expects it, or maybe I've expected it as a spouse. And so they share with me this really vulnerable thought that, you know, I don't want to be that ever ready, always wanting sex partner. Is that going to damage my image of who they are, that somehow doesn't seem manly to me? Right. So I think that's just one small example, but there could be a lot of things that we've created an image for our spouse. And then when they don't match up, we create the conflict because they're wanting to make adjustments and not necessarily maintain that image.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I believe that's the place at which we need to remind ourselves of our commitment to pursue that which is true and good, rather than comfortable and reassuring, and that that can give us the strength that we need to go beyond our, you know, preconceived notions and expectations that we've placed on our partners to be a particular way, to reflect back to us what we think we need.
Exactly. I love that. So what if a couple is having some struggles sexually? What would be some, you know, ideas or some suggestions you would give for them to explore that and maybe begin the healing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's important to have some kind of behavioral experiment that they can be doing all the time, that we can modify according to the feedback that they bring each session. So it's at the beginning of treatment that I will typically start with the one that I mentioned before, where they're going to be taking consistent opportunity to at least clearly express, this is where I am emotionally, and this is where I want to be physically, and what exactly is in between those two. And so this, I would say this process really only works if you're prepared for things to get worse, at least initially, before they get better. And so that's something that I ask partners and couples to consider, is how bad do you want this to get better? It's certainly very understandable that what you want is to reduce the stress and pain and even panic that you've been experiencing. But if that is your top goal, I don't know that I can help you, because I don't believe that whatever you successfully accomplish under that frame is sustainable.
Mm. Yeah.
So but of course we have to address that, right? And so that's where I will talk to clients about how aware are you of your own triggers, let's say, or propensity to be flooded emotionally, and what are the skills that you have for self-soothing? How will you survive the kind of emotional dysregulation and panic you will feel if you go where you need to improve this?
Hmm. Yeah, it's a process, right? And so if you're not willing to go through the process, if you just want things to be better, you may not be successful, because it's going to require some patience, some sitting with the suffering for, you know, some period of time anyway.
Yeah. Like, I would agree with you that if the focus is for it to be better, they'll be okay. But if the initial or primary goal is for it to feel better,
yeah,
then we're off track.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that distinction too. So what would you mentioned self-soothing, you know, what are your skills for self-soothing? How would you describe self-soothing, first of all? And then what sorts of tips would you give for someone who's just learning about self-soothing and wants to improve their capacity for self-soothing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say self-soothing is about calming yourself down emotionally, independently, without assistance, without reassurance or especially coddling, but even genuine reassurance from others. How well are you able to independently remind yourself that you will survive the emotional pain that you're experiencing, and your worth is not dependent on your regulation or even on your behavior related to whatever it is that you're triggered by? We'll talk about, you know, what can you do inside of your own mind when you feel. So I'll ask them to consider, okay, so you know the sensations perhaps that you feel inside of your body. And so those are probably your first indicators. And then it might go up to the mind, and you start to hear things from yourself or from the past, possibly from other people, depending on your history, right? Like, but there are ideas that are dominating the triggering experience. And so what do you want to say back mentally and emotionally and spiritually to those? And so you need tactics for being able to notice and breathe through the physiological sensations of triggering, as well as actual arguments to give back to, you know, to contest the negative and the kind of pathological thoughts that we come up with when we're triggered.
Hmm. Yeah, I really like that. I've been studying a little lately about how noticing When we receive an emotional injury, you know, whether it's self-inflicted or something that our partner said, when we receive an emotional injury, to just like sit with yourself for a minute and kind of be a little curious about how that impacts you physiologically, right? Do I get really worked up? Do I get a pit in my stomach, start breathing faster? Maybe I'm just so agitated physically that it's hard for me to settle down. So I love that you're saying, you know, it's this two-layer response. I have to calm myself physically, but then I also have to kind of reason with myself and work through this injury emotionally, you know, intellectually even.
And I would say that the body demands attention first, and that's okay. That's not a sign of immaturity on our part. It's a sign. It's an indicator that our bodies are working.
That's
right. And that they are, you know, and they are connected with our minds and our spirits, I would say. And so simple breathing exercises can work wonders for people to at least get themselves down to a place, let's say, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, at least get down to an 8, 7.57, to where then you can reason again.
Yes.
And start to do the mental work needed to take yourself down even further.
Yeah, I don't think that we've talked about this, but that's part of what my research is just on mindfulness, right? Mm-hmm, so learning to regulate your body, but also your thoughts, your emotions, so that you can respond more intentionally, right? If I'm really worked up, if my heart rate is going up, I'm kind of acting under, you know, these kind of primitive emotions and fear, I'm just going to act in the fight or flight mode. I'm probably not going to get the best results, right? I'm not going to get these nuanced, elegant results that I'm hoping to achieve when I'm in the middle of conflict. But if my physical response is what we're talking about, it kind of incapacitates me. And so, yeah, just breathing, kind of getting down to that, at least where I can start using my, you know, executive functioning, the front part of my brain, that's when I can start making a little more nuanced comments and not so reactive and much more able to connect with my partner rather than just automatically moving into these triggered responses that generally aren't helpful.
Right. And that's one thing that I'm careful to discuss with couples before they begin any of these experiments that we do together or design together, is you'll want to become very adept and you'll be clumsy at first, and that's fine. That's always, you know, clumsiness always precedes mastery, and you'll want to become aware of where you are emotionally, and so that you are aware of that and can control that or regulate that rather than your partner. So be aware of, oh, I feel flooded. Am I all the way at a 10? Am I still about an 8? What am I going to do about it? And so what I'll say is, so you'll both want to be stretching yourselves in primarily like a growth promoting zone. So I kind of arbitrarily said, well, how about, you know, 6.5 to 7.5, you know, anything, you know, below 6.5 is kind of like mashed potatoes and gravy, comfort food. And we talk about that physically too, or sexually, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with comfort food, but if you're going for a growth promoting experience, if these particular experiments are about growth, if you don't stretch at least to that level of stress needed for growth, nothing is going to change. So how are you going to hover right around there? And then of course you are going to suddenly get flooded, go a little too far. That's where you're going to plug in your skills, get yourself back down to at least 7.5, then try again. And how are you going to stand by your own emotional experience if your partner doesn't behave very well in response to your efforts to self-regulate? Are you going to be willing to stand for your own experience and say, I need a break? Even if that hurts your feelings, and even if you're angry, and even if you're going to pout, like, I need this time, and then I will be prepared to return and we can talk about this.
Yeah. And I think that's the key for, you know, a little more emotionally mature relationships. As you say, you can admit, I need to step back here for a minute. Let me go take 20 minutes or a half an hour on my own and I'll be back, right? We give this time frame of when you can expect. It's like, you know, we don't set a child on timeout and say, yeah, you're there till I feel like you can get off or I decide to come back and get you. No, we give them a time limit. We say, you know, you're there for 5 minutes and I want you to think about how you can change or I want you to calm down or whatever the goal is. And I think we need to do a little bit of that, like you mentioned, nurturing with our spouse, right? So here we are in kind of this a little more intense conversation where things are a little bit fragile. We can still give them the reassurance that I'm still in this relationship. I'm still working. Me leaving is because physically I'm a little too aroused. It's things are too intense for me, but I am going to come back. I'm going to come back and we can address this when I'm in a much more regulated state.
Right. Precisely.
Great. Well, any other advice or comments you might give to our listeners?
I hope that any partner or couple listening doesn't feel alone in the struggle, not only to have a emotionally intimate relationship, but especially a sexually intimate relationship. It's very common to feel like you have just about everything else in your relationship figured out except sex. And that it's not an indication of deficiency of drive or commitment or integrity that you're in pain about this and that you're not sure what to do next and that it's worth the journey no matter how long it takes.
I love that. I think that often we think in our sexual relationships that they were just gonna emerge and mm-hmm. that it would just happen naturally, like it was an instinct. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of couples are surprised when that doesn't happen. And then just like you said, they may feel alone or they may feel deficient mm-hmm. or that they did something wrong. And I think the good news, and you've given so many great skills today, the good news is no, there's nothing wrong. This is the process. This mm-hmm. is the process of developing a healthy adult sexual relationship with someone you're committed to, you love them, you're going to work through these issues, but it does take some skills and some growth.
That's right.
Well, thank you for giving us, you know, a few extra skills today and maybe helping us think about things in a different way. I'm going to keep pondering the water and heat and mm-hmm. Think about how I would categorize my own experience. Thank you so much. I so appreciate you being here with us.
You're welcome. I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you, Shalom.
Yeah, thanks. That's it for this week. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Sexual Mindfulness Project and subscribe to our website, shalomlevitt.com, to stay up to date with the latest information on sexual mindfulness. Thanks for listening.